Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back, or hopefully welcome back. I hope everyone hasn't forgotten about the podcast because it has been a while since we last released an episode. This week's case took quite a long time to research, so I was glad to have additional time to work on it and that we're finally here recording. So let's not waste any more time and get right into it. But before we do, there will be mention of sexual assault and suicide in today's case, so please listen with caution. Jennifer Karras was 19 years old at the time of her death in 1998. Raised in Florida, Jennifer was a natural performer from a young age. She's been described as vibrant, funny, and she always kept her parents, John and Barbara, guessing. Jennifer loved to sing, dance, and act. So as she got a little bit older, she was eager to get involved in the theater department at her high school. One of her high school teachers shared with the Orlando Sentinel that Jennifer was the true epitome of what a thespian is. Not only did she act in various productions, but she also took on the role of director and choreographer in other productions. She was involved with the Orlando Civic Theater, where she directed and choreographed performances for the Children's Summer Program. During her senior year of high school, Jennifer began researching colleges and universities, searching for the one that best matched her interests. She intended to major in theater, aspiring to one day become a theater teacher. One college that came on her radar was Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida, near Orlando. This is a small, private, liberal arts college, and her parents were pretty excited about Jennifer's interest in this school because it was close to home, just a short drive away, and the college marketed itself as running a very safe campus. I'm sure these factors made it easier to justify sending Jennifer to such an expensive college. Back in the late 90s, it was about $27,000 per academic year for tuition and room and board. So Jennifer ultimately decided Rollins College was a good fit for her. She applied, was accepted, and before she knew it, she was starting this new chapter of life in 1996. Jennifer quickly made friends with many of the other theater students, including a young woman named Shannon. Shannon was interviewed about Jennifer's case for a series called Accident, Suicide, or Murder, in which she shared that she and Jennifer bonded instantly. It was something she couldn't quite explain, but they grew close quickly. However, a few months before Jennifer's death, so toward the end of 1997, beginning of 1998, Jennifer began to spend more time with a different group of friends outside of the theater department. So Jennifer had a boyfriend named Paul, who was in the Tau Kappa Epsilon fraternity. Shannon said this was more of a party crowd than what Jennifer was used to. And it sounded to me like Jennifer hadn't completely drifted away from Shannon and her other friends. She was still close with them. She just began spending more time with Paul and his friends.
So what did Shannon and Jennifer's other friends and her family think about Paul?
Jennifer's parents, who were also interviewed for accident, suicide, or murder, said that they'd only met Paul one time and described him as sort of standoffish. I got the impression that they were not that impressed with Paul, and neither were her close friends. And in general, it seemed like Jennifer's parents felt that she didn't have the best judgment when it came to the people she dated. On March 30th, 1998, Jennifer went to a restaurant with some friends where she had a few drinks between 8:30 and 10:30 p.m. Afterward, she visited Paul, who was watching college basketball with some of his fraternity brothers at one of the dorms. Paul noticed that Jennifer seemed very out of it and extremely intoxicated, which led to an argument between them. He was frustrated by how drunk she had become. Now, I wish I could tell you how much she had to drink. Sure, maybe Paul wouldn't know exactly how much she had while hanging out with them, but you'd think he could come up with an estimate. And the reason this feels so important is because of something I will share later. Shortly before 3 a.m., Paul asked one of the fraternity pledges, Tim, to walk Jennifer back to her dorm. And not just walk her back to ensure she got home safely, but walk her back because she was too out of it to physically walk back unassisted. When Jennifer's friend Shannon heard about this later, she told Accident, Suicide, or Murder that she was shocked. In her experience, Jennifer did not get to this level of intoxication on any sort of a regular basis. So it was certainly surprising to hear. Also, after the fact, when Jennifer's parents learned that Paul asked someone else to walk Jennifer home instead of walking her back to her dorm himself, they were annoyed. They felt he, as her boyfriend, should have done that. So Tim walked Jennifer back to her dorm, which was just about 400 feet or 120 meters from the dorm they'd been hanging out in. The following day, Tuesday, March 31st, 1998, Jennifer failed to show up for her classes throughout the entire day, something she was not known to do. Shannon and other friends were concerned for Jennifer. So Shannon called Jennifer's mom, Barbara, asking if she'd gone home for some reason. Barbara indicated that Jennifer was not at their house and she assumed she was at school. From there, the worry intensified. Barbara began calling the phone in Jennifer's dorm room repeatedly, receiving no answer. Later that night, Shannon went to Jennifer's dorm, knocked on the door, got no response, and heard nothing coming from inside. She couldn't enter Jennifer's dorm either because the door was locked. At that point, Shannon requested help from the dorm's resident assistant, a student named Carlos. Carlos had a key to all of the dorms, so Shannon was hoping he could let her in. As Carlos and Shannon stood outside of Jennifer's door, they heard the phone ringing and it was Barbara continuing to call. So understanding the urgency of the situation, Carlos agreed to unlock Jennifer's door and enter the room with Shannon. Inside, they made a gruesome discovery. Jennifer was lying face down on the floor, barefoot, next to her bed with her right arm and leg still kind of up on the bed. Reportedly, there was a thin blanket covering part of her body, but he could see that her skirt was hiked up in the back and her underwear had been pulled upward from the back. It looked like they'd been yanked up. Essentially, they were not in a natural position, even if Jennifer had, let's say, fallen out of her bed. Additionally, there was some sort of fluid, possibly blood, coming out of Jennifer's mouth. Carlos felt Jennifer's neck for a pulse, but it was stiff and cold. He knew she was dead. Shannon rushed to call the police, and Carlos answered Jennifer's phone, which had started ringing again after they entered the room. It was Jennifer's mom, and Carlos had to be the one to tell her that her daughter was dead and she needed to get to campus immediately. Jennifer's mom was in disbelief. How could her daughter be dead? She and Jennifer's dad, John, rushed to Rollins. When the first responders arrived, they confirmed that Jennifer was deceased. Jennifer's room looked as though there may have been a struggle. It was quite messy with items strewn about. And you might be thinking, well, maybe that's just how Jennifer was. But her family and friends always knew Jennifer to be organized and tidy. So the state of her dorm room was odd to them. This, combined with the way Jennifer's body was positioned and there being no explanation for her death led to an investigation by the Winter Park Police. While they waited for an autopsy to be conducted, they spoke with Paul, Tim, the pledge who walked into her home, and various other people who were at the frat party.
I'm sure you'll get into it, but I'm really curious to hear what Tim has to say, since he was apparently the last person to see Jennifer alive.
Right. So Tim told the police that Jennifer had a hard time walking back to her dorm. So he really had to support her with his body as they walked. And then once they got back to her room, Tim said he removed Jennifer's shoes and placed her on her bed on her back. He said she was nearly unconscious at that point, and he stepped away to go to the bathroom. But when he returned, Jennifer asked him not to leave, at which point he noticed foam or bubbles starting to come from her mouth.
I would like to think that at that point, he went to call for help or called paramedics or something, because, I mean, that's obviously not a normal thing to have happened.
Yeah, that's not normal. But unfortunately, Tim stuck around for 10 to 15 minutes, but left around 3 a.m. after he saw Jennifer had passed out. And I understand this is not Tim's girlfriend or even friend. He was just kind of roped into the situation. But to leave someone foaming at the mouth, who seems to be having trouble staying conscious, is rough to hear. I can't imagine what it felt like to be Jennifer's parents learning all of this. Okay, let's say he acted against better judgment and getting her some help. Would he not then go tell Paul that his girlfriend was foaming at the mouth? Maybe he did, and Tim and Paul decided not to tell anyone that, but this entire situation is disturbing. And just one more point on that, he said that he left her apparently lying on her back on her bed. And if she were foaming at the mouth, that doesn't seem like a very good position to be in. So if he didn't want to do anything else, the very least could have done was put Jennifer on her side before leaving her room. Tim was interviewed for a second time, and during that questioning, he added a couple more details, one being that Jennifer made statements about how she shouldn't have gotten so drunk, and the other that Jennifer was banging her head around. Tim was certain that he had left Jennifer's door unlocked when he left, so the police were perplexed by the fact that Jennifer's door was locked when Carlos and Shannon tried to enter her room. Did Jennifer lock the door sometime after Tim left? Did Tim actually lock the door and he's misremembering? Or did someone else enter Jennifer's room after Tim left and that person locked the door? This is a detail in this case that has never been clarified or resolved. We still don't know how Jennifer's door came to be locked if Tim left it unlocked. Paul shared much of what we've already discussed about his side of the story. He admitted that he was annoyed by Jennifer's level of intoxication, but after Tim took Jennifer home, there were plenty of witnesses who could corroborate Paul's whereabouts. I could find very little information about Paul. I didn't see any public statements from Paul or Tim, so it was hard to dig into them further, but I'm definitely curious about Paul's perspective here. When the police searched Jennifer's dorm room, they found a note with a phone number on it, and they learned that Jennifer had called this number 3 times the night before she died. It's unclear exactly when she was calling this number, but they pieced together that this phone number belonged to a young man, Skyler. He and Jennifer had dated in high school and had remained in contact since then. When Skyler spoke with the police, he said Jennifer sometimes sounded a bit despondent during their conversations and told him that she missed him that night. At other times, she seemed more upbeat, though she still continued to say that she missed him. Skyler was ruled out early on because he had a solid alibi. He also didn't seem to have any reason to want to harm Jennifer. So if anything, they took this as some insight into Jennifer's state of mind that night, but it was also conflicting. So I don't know that this information was that helpful. The task of conducting Jennifer's autopsy was given to Associate Medical Examiner Dr. Merle Reyes, assisted by board-certified forensic pathologist Dr. William Anderson. Jennifer's body had quite a few injuries, including bruising to her inner thighs, bruising and scrapes on her right knee, scrapes on her left knee. Both of her big toenails were broken off at the middle. She had various scrapes and bruises on her toes. Her nose and left upper eyelid were bruised. There was mild swelling in her brain, bruises and scrapes on her chin, 3 horizontal line-like bruises on her right cheek, bruising on her forehead and lips. None of these injuries alone explained Jennifer's death, right? It was a lot of various unexplained injuries across her whole body, but nothing that should have been deadly. Reading about Jennifer's toenails was like nails on a chalkboard. That had to be so painful to split down the middle like that. And there were what were described as these blue flecks of paint on Jennifer's broken toenails that were the same color as a box sitting against the wall of her dorm, less than a foot from her feet. So it's been theorized that her feet and toes slammed into that box at some point before she died. I was picturing this as a metal box, but I'm not totally clear what kind of box we're talking about here. And as I said, none of these injuries could explain Jennifer's death, but that wasn't all they uncovered. Hemorrhage was present in the soft tissue of Jennifer's neck. After identifying this, Dr. Reyes enlisted the assistance of the other pathologist I mentioned, Dr. Anderson. Together, they did a layered dissection of Jennifer's neck. Significant hemorrhage was found in the deeper neck muscles, consistent with the application of substantial pressure to that part of her neck. During their dissection and throughout the autopsy overall, they made sure to take photographs. The possibility formed that a struggle may have ensued between Jennifer and someone else, and they thrust their arm around Jennifer's neck, applying that pressure.
So with the thigh and the neck injuries, it definitely seems like there's another person involved here. It doesn't seem like she was just tumbling around.
Yeah, I was struck by the bruising to her inner thighs. It just seems like an odd place to have bruises without bruising elsewhere on her thighs. And then I thought the broken toenails seemed really strange as well, if Jennifer died alone in her room. Some of the other bruising and abrasions you could say were the result of Jennifer stumbling home with Tim. But like you said, now you have these other injuries, and the neck injury was the most important. So Reyes and Anderson were leaning toward ruling the manner of death a homicide, but needed to wait for the toxicology results and the rape kit to come back before making a conclusion. During this time, Reyes made it clear to police that she believed Jennifer's death was likely a homicide and that Jennifer may have been strangled during an attempted sexual assault, and that the perpetrator could have even unintentionally killed her. Reyes shared this with Detective Anthony Botello, who was leading the investigation into Jennifer's death. Botello had been an investigator for 3 years and had yet to investigate a homicide. And Reyes didn't just tell Botello about her suspicions. She actually called him to the morgue while Jennifer's body had just been inspected to show him the neck injury and other injuries she had. So you might think that Reyes sharing this with Botello would lead to expedited results on his end. Instead, Botello left specimens from the rape exam at the morgue for 10 weeks. He waited until mid-June 1998 to deliver them to the state crime lab for testing. Time is of the essence in a situation such as this, and to make this critical error feels almost like a slap in the face of Jennifer's family. Ultimately, the rape kit did not confirm that Jennifer was raped. There was no seminal fluid transfer. This did not completely rule out the matter, though, and it didn't rule out that there was an attempted sexual assault that did not go through for some reason. Once the rape exam results were released, that left the toxicology, which was very much of interest. I mean, it's an important part of any postmortem examination, but particularly in Jennifer's case, you had these statements of her being very inebriated. So they wanted to know how much alcohol was in Jennifer's system, as well as any other drugs. And what came out was surprising to everyone. There was almost no alcohol in Jennifer's body, which means she had metabolized the alcohol already at the time of her death. Reports about this suggest that could have taken 7 to 8 hours. To which I say, where does that 7 to 8 hours come from? Because on average, it takes your body about an hour to metabolize one standard drink. So for them to be saying it could have taken 7 to 8 hours, I would think there was an estimate for how many drinks she had. Otherwise, I don't see how they could come up with that time frame. So based on this, Jennifer either had something like 14 drinks with the assumption that she stopped around 2:30 and drank at a steady rate starting at 8:30 the night before and died around the middle of the day after she went out. Or she did not have as much to drink as people assumed and the alcohol already metabolized and she died shortly after Tim brought her back to her room. And the latter theory doesn't make much sense until you know what else was in Jennifer's system. There was a toxic level of the medication propranolol detected in Jennifer's body. Propranolol is a beta blocker that is used for cardiovascular conditions like high blood pressure, but it can also be used to treat migraines and is sometimes prescribed off-label for situational anxiety as it can be effective in managing the physical symptoms that often come along with situational anxiety. Side effects include slowed heart rate, dizziness, fatigue, nausea, and diarrhea. It is recommended to limit alcohol consumption while taking this medication. So if that's the case with a therapeutic dose, you can imagine the issues that could arise from combining the level that was in Jennifer's body with alcohol. That level alone was a high concentration. But here's the thing. Jennifer was not prescribed this medication. None of her friends recalled her ever speaking of it, and they weren't sure if she even knew what it was. And outside of Jennifer, her friends said they'd never heard anyone talking about it. Propranolol would not give someone a high per se, but it could be abused in the sense that it masks those physical symptoms that come with anxiety sometimes. That's it, though. It's not like kids all over Rollins College were using this medication while partying. Also detected were a couple of over-the-counter cold medications, including pseudoephedrine or Sudafed, Tylenol, Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant she was prescribed, a barbiturate called Butalbital, and I don't know if she had a prescription for that one. So Jennifer had exposure to a number of medications, although none of the substances appeared to be present at lethal levels individually. Their combined effects could have compromised her cardiac function. And the propranolol was the most concerning one. The toxicology results certainly raised questions. Why did Jennifer take propranolol and so much of it? Did she know what she was taking? Did she know she was taking it at all? And this is why I brought up the idea that maybe people assumed Jennifer had more to drink than she did, because with the levels of propranolol in her system, it could mimic the effects of someone who is highly intoxicated. I can kind of see a situation where the people at this frat party just naturally assumed that Jennifer was very drunk. Now, of course, if a bunch of people saw Jennifer have drink after drink that night, then that's a different story, but that has not been presented. With this information, we now know someone else is involved here to a degree. She had to get the propranolol from someone, so who was it? No one has admitted that they gave Jennifer this medication. Once Dr. Reyes had the toxicology report, it did not change her opinion of homicide, but multi-drug intoxication was considered a contributing factor in Jennifer's death rather than the only reason. They still had no explanation for the trauma to Jennifer's neck. They believed that Jennifer's heart was sensitized by the drugs when she experienced a neck compression, which could lead to a lack of oxygen that caused cardiac arrhythmia. Therefore, 5 months after Jennifer's death, Dr. Reyes ruled Jennifer's manner of death a homicide and cause of death, blunt force trauma, and compressive asphyxia.
Yeah, the propranolol is just bizarre. I'm wondering if she maybe tried to buy certain drugs and someone just gave her this beta blocker drug.
Telling her it was something else, right?
Yeah, right. And that's how it was in her system. It's just such a weird drug to have in your system if you weren't prescribed it.
Especially so much of it. I wondered about that as well. I was like, okay, maybe someone she knew was prescribed this beta blocker for, let's say, anxiety, and that's why they would be willing to sell it, because if it's for situational anxiety, you're not taking it every single day, most likely. So maybe it is something where you could have extra of this, and then some person took advantage of that and thought, oh, I can make money off this and just tell people that this is some other drug and then give them this and then they can make a quick buck, right? I think that would explain why no one said anything about giving this to Jennifer, because obviously that's a wrong thing to do. I think there's also the possibility, you know, some have speculated that someone put this medication in her drink. If she was drinking that night, they were spiking her drink, so to speak. But I mean, it's a really strange drug to do that with. And my goodness, how much would someone have to put in her drink to reach the level that was in her system? You would think that if someone was dropping multiple pills in a person's drink, they might notice, or at least the amount that I would think she would have to swallow to reach that level. And then you have all the other kind of various medications in her system. And it's like, did she take every single one of those intentionally? Like, what was going on here? Before Jennifer's family could fully process the news that Jennifer's death had been ruled a homicide, they were hit with a sudden and disorienting turn of events. After Dr. Reyes ruled it a homicide, the Winter Park police should have investigated further. Instead, they requested that Orange County's chief medical examiner, Dr. Sashi Gore, re-review the autopsy results because they couldn't find much evidence to support this being a murder. Dr. Reyes reported to Dr. Gore. Dr. Gore was not board certified, but he did have 40 years of experience. Dr. Gore had a different interpretation of Jennifer's injuries and the toxicology results. He formed the opinion that most of Jennifer's injuries could be attributed to her stumbling around in her dorm and on the walk back home with Tim. Tim had indicated that Jennifer had crawled on her hands and knees on a sidewalk at one point, which could explain the scrapes or bruises on her knees. But otherwise, the Orlando Sentinel reported that he said he held her up on the walk back and she was not repeatedly falling. Dr. Gore believed Jennifer's neck injury could be explained by the position she was in on the floor.
Didn't the previous medical examiners say that the injuries on her neck would have had to have been caused by substantial or very intense compressive force?
Yes.
Not just body weight, basically.
Not just like sitting up against something for a while, right? They said it would be an external force that caused that level of injury, right? So this was odd. And Gore presented his opinions to some of his colleagues without including Dr. Reyes. And when questioned about that choice after the fact, he stated he didn't need to include her because he was her supervisor. By mid-October 1998, 6 months after Jennifer's death, Dr. Gore officially overturned the homicide ruling. He ultimately reclassified her death, stating that Jennifer died from a heart attack brought on by the combined toxicity of several prescription drugs. However, because it could not be determined whether the drugs were taken accidentally or intentionally with the awareness of what the outcome would be, he ruled the manner of death undetermined. Dr. Gore believed the homicide ruling resulted from a misinterpretation of Jennifer's injuries, though he emphasized that he still had full confidence in Dr. Reyes. When Dr. Reyes and Dr. Anderson learned all of this, they were surprised that they had not been involved in the discussion. They saw Jennifer's body. Dr. Gore did not. You would think he would have wanted to consult with them, but maybe he felt he already had access to all the information they could possibly give him. When Dr. Gore made this change, he revised the description of Jennifer's neck injury from moderate to severe, as Dr. Reyes classified it, to minimal. This was significant because the neck injury had been the linchpin of the homicide ruling. Dr. Anderson told Accident, Suicide, or Murder that he questioned Dr. Gore about this, and Dr. Gore retorted that there was no injury of significance to Jennifer's neck. So Dr. Anderson essentially said, "What do you mean? Just look at the photos. It's abundantly clear." To which Dr. Gore said there was only one photo of the neck area. But this was not true. Dr. Anderson and Dr. Reyes took multiple photos. So it turned out that these images had either been misplaced or misfiled, but they were nowhere to be found and have never been found.
I wonder why Dr. Gore didn't ask Dr. Reyes and Dr. Anderson why they didn't have more photos of the neck area, since it was a significant part of the examination. What if there was only one photo in there? Why he could have used it as like a learning opportunity, I suppose.
Exactly.
Like if it's such a big part of their examination and they only have one photo, that's not very substantial evidence.
Right. And it's not like they forgot to take multiple photos of just one part of her body that had no injuries. This is the most significant injuries. And it struck me as a little bit of a red flag. Like, it can't be best practice to have one photo from an autopsy. So if you can't find the photos with the file, like you said, go back to the original source and inquire about this. Instead, he didn't inquire about it and overturned their decision without even asking those questions. So it's up for debate how significant the hemorrhage to Jennifer's neck was, but one decision was made with more information than the other. And one more detail here is that Dr. Reyes presented her finding of homicide to the county's chief homicide prosecutor and several experienced investigators before making that final ruling. And they were all in agreement with her. They agreed with her finding of homicide. With this new cause of death, the Winter Park police didn't stop investigating immediately, but it seemed to slow down. And a year and a half after Jennifer's death, her case was closed and considered an accidental death. And one of the reasons they didn't stop investigating right away is because they were still looking into if someone could be charged with supplying the propranolol to Jennifer. But clearly that never went anywhere and no one was charged with that kind of crime. In 2003, 5 years after Jennifer's death, Dr. Reyes resigned from her position after a dispute with Dr. Gore. It was at this time that she finally spoke out publicly about Jennifer's death in an interview with the Orlando Sentinel. Reyes stated that she categorically believed Jennifer's death was a homicide and that her position had never wavered despite claims that Dr. Gore told Jennifer's family she agreed with his new ruling. Two other pathologists who were involved in Jennifer's autopsy, including Dr. Anderson, spoke out at this time as well to share their support of Reyes. When Reyes spoke out, a lot of previously unrevealed information came out. For starters, remember Detective Botello, who was tasked with investigating Jennifer's case? He resigned from his position a few years after Jennifer's death, after he was disciplined for violating the trust of a 23-year-old rape victim in a case he was working. He reportedly called this woman multiple times, asking her out for drinks and revealing a sexual fantasy he had about inspecting her body for cigarette burns. Botello was aware that she was receiving psychiatric care for burning and cutting herself, so that's where that originated.
Jennifer's family must have been really disappointed and probably even pretty angry that this was the type of person that was the lead investigator of their daughter's murder or apparent murder.
Yeah, I would be so mad if I were her family and knew that this was the person investigating her case. We already knew he made some mistakes, but this is like next level. This is who was in charge, at least for some time. Like, that's what I would be thinking to myself. And Botello managed to get a new job as a police officer in another state where he was later fired. There are other claims against Botello that you can read about online if you're interested, but I agree that I would be highly disappointed and upset that this is the person who was investigating my family member's case, because it calls into question their, not only their ethics, but how dedicated they were to actually investigating cases. Somewhat related, there were a number of investigative mishaps that came out. Carlos, the RA who discovered Jennifer, told the Orlando Sentinel that investigators asked him little more than whether her door was locked. Carlos expressed surprise at the limited questioning, believing that as the person who found her, he would be interviewed more extensively. Allegedly, about 5 months after Jennifer's death, Botello decided he wanted to interview Carlos, but he was studying abroad in Madrid and failed to contact him. Not that anyone believes Carlos had anything to do with Jennifer's death, but you expect more from the investigators, and it makes you question if they didn't do something as simple as this, what else was left open-ended? Well, I can tell you something else. Hairs were found inside Jennifer's mouth. And although they were collected and preserved, they were never tested to determine whether they belonged to Jennifer or someone else. There was also a hair on her leg that was not tested. The samples were stored in glass vials and were ultimately discarded. The Winter Park police chief defended this decision, stating that there was only one person they could compare the hair to, and that was Jennifer herself. So the results of such testing would not have changed the course of the investigation. Now, we can understand not having anyone to compare to besides Jennifer. They didn't have a suspect strong enough or a suspect at all to get a warrant for something like that. However, why not go ahead and compare it to Jennifer's hair? The hairs were in her mouth. Would it not change matters if the hairs conclusively did not belong to Jennifer? How are they comfortable just leaving that as an unknown? Let's say they didn't belong to her. If the night went how everyone said it did and this was an accident, at what point are hairs getting inside Jennifer's mouth and staying there until the point of the autopsy? It's not to say it's impossible that they ended up there for a reason unrelated to her death, but when you have a suspicious death like this, every avenue has to be explored.
Yeah, I could see the scenario where her hair is on her pillow. She rolls over and her mouth is open. Then somehow they get in her mouth. I could see that happening. But yeah, I agree. The bare minimum would be to confirm that those hairs are actually hers.
Right. And Jennifer's parents, this was another disappointment for them to find this out, because they didn't know this initially, to find out that this was missed or deliberately not investigated. And look, maybe the sample of hair wasn't very good. Maybe the root wasn't intact. There could be some issues here, but nobody said that. And I'm thinking, at least say that if that was one of the reasons. The chief also disputed the accounts that Jennifer's underwear was hiked up, stating that there was no record of this. But Carlos indicated that no one asked him about this. It sounded like he had hardly spoken to anyone. So maybe it didn't get reported, but Carlos remembered that detail clearly. And he was backed up by John Flynn, the Winter Park police officer, who showed up a few minutes after the authorities were called. The chief suggested that John couldn't have seen this because Jennifer's body was already covered up when he arrived. John, however, said that Jennifer's body was only partially covered, and he did, in fact, see what Carlos saw. So there's this theme in this case where you have people who saw something with their own eyes, in this case, Carlos and John, and then you have the chief who was not on the scene, who was disputing what the people on the scene saw. Similarly to the autopsy being overturned, where you have the people who saw Jennifer's body and conducted the autopsy, who said the trauma to Jennifer's neck was significant, and then Dr. Gore, who did not conduct the autopsy and only had one photo of Jennifer's neck, saying the neck trauma was not significant. There were other concerns about the investigation. Botello reportedly waited months to contact a rape crisis center, despite Dr. Reyes suggesting Jennifer's death could have involved an attempted sexual assault. This specific rape crisis center was of interest because Jennifer had one of their contact cards in her dorm. When the center was finally contacted, they didn't know why Jennifer had one of their cards. Also, Botello allegedly failed to recover any fingerprints from Jennifer's room and did not seek a second review. Like, apparently didn't even find Jennifer's fingerprints in her room. Botello's position during all of this was that he was too busy. His caseload was overwhelming, but Jennifer's death was the only potential murder he was investigating that we know of. And not to say the other crimes he was investigating weren't important, but you'd think a potential murder would be given the appropriate attention it deserves.
Yeah, not to reduce the other crimes he was investigating, but if this is the only potential murder on his plate, you'd think that that would go to the top of the priority list to catch a dangerous person that's out there, if it was in fact a murder.
You would think, yeah, because until that person's caught, other people are at risk. You don't know if they could strike again, but for whatever reason, it seems like this case was not prioritized.
Yeah, it seemed like a weak cop-out to just say, oh, I was too busy. Like, what?
I know. Yeah, he said he had all these other robberies and assaults and felonies that he was investigating. So that was his position.
Could have told his boss and had someone else investigate it. You know, there's a million different things he could have done rather than just not do a thorough investigation.
Right. And putting off tasks that seem like they shouldn't take that long is really weird to me. Like, just go take the samples from the rape kit to the crime lab. Like, why are we sitting on that for so long, for weeks and weeks? That's what's frustrating. We understand agencies have limited resources a lot of the time. But again, this was the only potential murder he was investigating. So you'd think there'd be some priority. After all this information surfaced and the pathologist spoke out, the Winter Park police chief requested an outside review, and it was announced that the Orange Osceola State Attorney's Office would review the department's investigation. The results of that investigation were released in a 4-page report in January 2004, which was almost 6 years after Jennifer's death. Assistant State Attorney Stephen Foster concluded that they could not definitively say whether Jennifer's death was a homicide or not. Jennifer's mom, Barbara, felt like their inability to determine anything should have warranted Jennifer's case being reopened. Her father, John, told the Orlando Sentinel, quote, "Mr. Foster's statements to the press that he found no evidence to rule this a homicide struck me as ironic. The Winter Park police threw away the hair found in my daughter's body. Maybe it was the evidence that was needed to prove that it was a homicide," end quote. So Jennifer's parents were clearly frustrated and at times have expressed concern that the Winter Park police could be protecting Rollins College. Prospective students and their parents hearing that a student was murdered on campus is different from hearing that a student accidentally died. a murder could potentially hurt admissions and the reputation of the college. And it was interesting looking at some of the articles from early on. Actually, there was hardly anything until Dr. Reyes classified Jennifer's death. But then there were statements from investigators that students shouldn't be worried. If Jennifer was murdered, at that time, it was the first homicide to have occurred on campus in the school's 113-year history. I don't see why students shouldn't have been worried at that time. But this topic reminds me of our very first episode with the Kansas College rapist. In that case, I feel like the two universities involved kept quiet about the fact that there was a rapist on the loose targeting students. So did that happen here? Was it intentional? We don't know. A couple of months after the findings of that investigation came out, an additional toxicology review was completed at the University of Florida by forensic toxicologist Bruce Goldberger. He reported that Jennifer consumed the equivalent of 2 bottles of medicine and other prescription drugs in the hours before her death.
Did he provide any further explanation of what 2 bottles of medicine actually means? What is that measurement?
No, I was confused by that as well. A bottle of medicine is not a standard measure. I mean, he provided more details, but that was just kind of like the headline of like, oh, she had 2 bottles of medicine in her system, even though that's not a standard measure. As a toxicologist, he is looking at the drug levels that were found in Jennifer's body. He was not a medical doctor looking at it through the same lens as like Dr. Reyes or Dr. Anderson. Goldberger contended that the levels of propranolol and pseudoephedrine were so elevated that she could not have taken them earlier and lived long enough for the alcohol to clear her system. He also doubted that an intoxicated individual could have consumed enough pills to reach those levels and noted that the remaining drugs in combination may have been sufficient to cause death. Based on this, he suggested that the manner of death could have been suicide. To put this in other words, the idea is that, okay, maybe Jennifer had some of these medications, maybe the over-the-counter ones or what she was prescribed in her system when Tim brought her back to her dorm, but not the levels that were detected. There is a built-in assumption here that Jennifer was very intoxicated from alcohol when Tim brought her back to her room. So then they're saying enough time passed, hours passed after that, the alcohol metabolized, and then Jennifer consumed the propranolol and pseudoephedrine in such elevated levels that she would not have survived long after that. And Dr. Reyes was critical of Goldberger's whole assessment seemingly being based on this assumption that Jennifer was very drunk, right? It's a huge factor in this case. And we don't know that with certainty. Like we've talked about already, Reyes pointed out that what was in her system, all of that combined, could have mimicked what someone looks like when they're drunk. And I don't think anyone's saying Jennifer had nothing to drink that night. I think there are a couple of different ways you can look at this. So it seems odd to place so much certainty on Jennifer having a lot of alcohol the night before her death. There was an open bottle of Wellbutrin in Jennifer's room. That was the antidepressant she was prescribed. So I think that was sort of used to bolster this theory. Like maybe she was just taking anything she could find. There was no propranolol bottle in her room, which makes sense since it wasn't prescribed to her. But I guess if she willingly took this, she had a lot of it somehow, like access to a lot of it, and took everything she had because it wasn't in her room. Something I would like to know is if the bottle of Wellbutrin that was open in her room was completely empty. It's always just reported that it was an open bottle. I did see a photo of the medicine bottle on her dresser and it was tipped over. It looks like it could have been empty, but you really cannot tell from that photo alone. If it had nothing in it, that is concerning and could be seen as a sign that she was taking all the medication she could have found in her room. But Of course, she could have been low on that medication anyway, but most people don't let the antidepressants get empty because that could create a lapse in taking that medication that you don't want. And I mentioned Jennifer's room earlier, how it looked like there could have been a struggle in there, and the state of her room was just very odd for Jennifer. She was known to be tidy and clean and organized. Her room didn't look like that at all. And when I saw the photos of it, it looks like, yes, it could partially be that some of the mess occurred during a struggle, but it also just looked like that's how she had been living. And it was, there was just like clothes everywhere, like stuff everywhere. Nothing was in order. And I think anyone who knows me would know that I'm very organized and tidy, and like her bedroom would never look like that. So my thought was like, if I got to that point and my space was looking like that, you would know it was very unwell. So it made me question, how was Jennifer doing? What was her state of mind like at this time? We really don't know a lot about that. So it did just have me questioning that, but it could be as simple as maybe she wasn't quite as tidy as everyone described. If Jennifer was murdered and it happened shortly after she got back to her dorm, the explanation for the alcohol being metabolized is that she was not as drunk as everyone thought, and she was exhibiting the effects of these elevated levels of medication in her system. A key issue there would be if witnesses could say for a fact they saw her drinking continuously that night, right? But we don't have that information. Now, just to throw a wrench in everything here, pathologist Dr. Anderson commented that there's a concept called post-mortem redistribution of drugs, where drugs can be concentrated in the tissue of the heart and liver and leak back into the blood after death, producing levels more elevated than actually existed. Dr. Anderson suggested that this could have happened in Jennifer's case. Interestingly, propranolol is one of the drugs most known for postmortem redistribution. It's actually considered a textbook example of it and might be why he raised this point. However, there are ways to mitigate this, such as taking blood from a different part of the body than the heart. I don't know what was done in this case specifically, but Dr. Anderson did raise this as a possibility. So I wanted to share this, even though we don't know if that's what occurred here. In April 2004, after pressure from Jennifer's family, among others, officials announced that Dr. Bruce Heima, the chief medical examiner of Miami-Dade County, would re-examine Jennifer's case. For John and Barbara, it was welcome news. Heima was highly experienced and had not been involved in the case, offering the promise of an impartial second look. They didn't know at the time that this would be the final investigation into Jennifer's death. The outcome of this investigation came out about a year after it began. And starting with the summary before the details here, this review characterized Jennifer's death as a final self-destructive gesture. Dr. Heima essentially concluded the death was a suicide, though he framed it more broadly, stating that the evidence suggested Jennifer ingested the drugs as a self-destructive act, so that leaves it a little more open. Someone can do something self-destructive without it being an intentional death. Heima reported that Jennifer had been treated for depression and faced struggles in her relationships, as well as issues with poor self-image, an eating disorder, and an interest in substance use culture. The police had learned that Jennifer allegedly experimented with various drugs and was sometimes depressed, which explains why she was prescribed Wellbutrin. So that wasn't much of a surprise. Heima believed the bruises on her neck and thighs resulted from her body lying in one position for hours. He's referring to liver mortis, along with her reported history of, or alleged history of, rough sexual encounters. He attributed the remaining bruises and abrasions to her having stumbled.
Shouldn't any doctor or examiner be able to tell the difference between the two, with liver mortis and any other sort of trauma to the body?
Yes, there are key differences between liver mortis or lividity and other trauma to the body, which is probably why this has never come up in a murder or suspicious death we've covered before. The layered dissection that was done of Jennifer's neck should have ruled out lividity as being the cause. So to see Dr. Haima cite this as though the other pathologists couldn't tell the difference was shocking. Dr. Anderson, who is a proponent of Jennifer's death being a murder, who saw Jennifer's body, even told Accident, Suicide, or Murder that if he were in Dr. Haima's position, he likely would have reached the same conclusion. The missing photos and incomplete information are a big deal. Dr. Haima didn't get to see Jennifer's body the same way as the original pathologist did. This review, though, was the last option for Jennifer's family. There was nothing left they could do, so they were forced to accept this as much as they could, knowing that unless someone spoke out, someone with information, Jennifer's death was not going to be investigated again. John and Barbara honored Jennifer's legacy by setting up the Jennifer Karras Memorial Foundation for the Performing Arts. Donations to the foundation went to scholarships for theater education students. They would never get their daughter back, but they could ensure her passion lived on by helping other students pursue the dreams she once held. Dr. Gore, the medical examiner who overturned Jennifer's manner of death from a homicide to an accident, was stripped of his authority to perform autopsies by the State Medical Examiner's Commission. This was the result of numerous errors in Dr. Gore's work and various complaints. A board-certified pathologist was hired to replace him, and several months later, he retired. So you can ingest that information as you like. In my opinion, Jennifer's case will only receive traction if someone with information steps forward. How did she get propranolol? It bothers me to no end that someone knows the answer to that. Questioned so many different ways as to how this night went down and how Jennifer died. I think, you know, we've talked about some of the possibilities, and it is still a possibility that someone wanted to sexually assault Jennifer. They put some pressure on her neck, a lot of pressure on her neck. And because of maybe the combination of that and the medication in her system, she died. And it could have been that this person did not premeditate murder, if this was a murder. There's also the possibility that this was an accident, this was a suicide. But I have a lot of reasonable doubt when it comes to those two possibilities.
Really wish we were able to get more information from Tim. I mean, he likely was the last person to see her alive, right? And it just seems like there has to be more there.
Tim is the elephant in the room. We have not really called out. He was never labeled a suspect, a person of interest, but yeah, it's hard not to look at him with some suspicion, because if you believe this is a murder, then you have to look at the last person who was with her. And then you could say maybe someone else came into her room at some point after he left. Did Paul go back to her room after Tim said something to him? How certain are we that Paul's whereabouts were completely corroborated for like the next few hours? It was getting pretty late. I mean, it was around 3 a.m. You would think these guys wrapped up their night shortly after that, or within an hour or two, you would think. After that point, could he be accounted for? I don't know. As I said, someone has to speak up. If they know something, if you have information related to the death of Jennifer Karras, please contact the Winter Park Police at 407-644-1313. This was a small college, okay? And it still is. When Jennifer was there, there were maybe 1,000 to 2,000 students. Ballpark. I suspect that someone knows how Jennifer got a hold of the medication she got a hold of. And I hope it's just eating that person away. And maybe there's nothing that can be done about it now, but the least they can do is provide that answer to Jennifer's family. That is certainly one of the mysteries within the broader mystery here of Jennifer's death. And I didn't mean to brush over the issues with Dr. Gore. That is a rabbit hole you are more than welcome to go down if you want. I just didn't think getting into all of the details made a lot of sense for this case, because I think it speaks for itself that Dr. Gore was barred from doing autopsies, and Dr. Reyes and Dr. Anderson were not. Wanted to let you all know that I have one or two cases that I definitely really want to cover next that I'll be working on. But if you have a case suggestion, you can always send those to us through our email at keytothecase@gmail.com or on Instagram at keytothecasepodcast. So once we get through the next couple of cases, I'll really be looking at what you all have suggested we cover and trying to pick cases from there. Thank you all so much for tuning in. If you are still sticking around despite a reduced schedule, we appreciate you so much. And we will hopefully be back before you know it. Bye.
Bye.